Okay, thanks very much. So I don't know whether I really am a legitimate physicist, but it's interesting that one of my motivations over the last 30 years for going into this, the area I'm going to be talking about today, is precisely to try to combine and make contact between my interest in the foundations of quantum mechanics and my more traditional interest in condensed matter physics. And I hope to convince you that there are some very important cross connections there. I usually start this talk or this series of talks showing a view graph in which I ask very in this, I won't show it this time, but this lecture I'm going to basically ask why should we even bother trying to do tests of the foundations of quantum mechanics, not, I should emphasize, not in my case at the level of single electrons or atoms, and certainly not at the subatomic or subnuclear scale, but rather at a level which goes towards that of our everyday consciousness, that is the macroscopic world. My first question is why bother, and I'll try to answer that in this lecture. And the second question I'll try to answer in this lecture is what exactly should we be looking for? What kinds of tests might we contemplate doing? And then in the next two lectures, I'll try to tell you about some of the tests which have been done, primarily over the last 10 years, and to ask what directions can we go in from here. So let me start off with something very, very elementary, which you're all, I think, very familiar with. This has to do with a rather generic situation in quantum mechanics in which one tries to demonstrate the phenomenon of interference. Now, I don't know, can this be read from the back? If not, we can try to expand it. Please tell me if at any time you want me to expand the view graphs, but if that's okay. Okay, so as I say, it's a very generic experiment. You could think of it as a young Slitz experiment, but at least in principle, we could do this experiment in a much more abstract kind of space. For example, the various states I'm talking about here could be different strangeness states, say, of the neutral chemical system, something like that. So we start off then with some set of microscopic objects, let's say for definiteness atoms, which start from some source, A. From that source, they can travel to a final point, E, at which they're going to be detected, and of course to other points as well, but we haven't bothered to indicate that. They can travel from A to E by either of two paths, B or C. So if we were talking about a literal Young-Slitz experiment, of course, this would be some kind of maybe incandescent source. This would be, B and C would be two slits and an intermediate screen, and E would be some kind of final screen, perhaps a photographic plate, something like that. But let me emphasize again, it's a very generic setup, even though I would have to say, to be honest, that if you asked me to name the specific systems in which the experiment I'm going to describe has been done, once I've exhausted the straight young slits, it's a little difficult to think of very many. But there have been others as well. Anyway, the young slits one would do for our purposes. Now, what we're going to arrange is that we have a device here which allows us either to inspect, this is a schematic of someone's eye, inspecting which of these states, B or C, a particular atom followed, or alternatively, we just close the shutter and refuse to inspect it. Let's define P sub B as the probability with only path B open. That is, we imagine that we shut off option C. In the case of a Young-Slitz experiment, we just do that by blocking it with some kind of opaque material. And by doing that, we measure the probability that a given atom starts from A, goes through B, and then ends up at E. So that the probability is just the total number arriving at E divided by the total number emitted by the source. Similarly, we define P sub C as the probability of any path C open. And then we define P sub B or C, that's perhaps a little question begging, but let me use that notation. P sub B or C is the probability of both the paths simultaneously open. Now, as you know, We can do this experiment, in principle at least, with or without inspection. In fact, if you come to think of it, it's not that trivial to do this, say, in a Young-Slitz experiment, because if you're dealing with photons, say, you can't really inspect the photon without destroying them, at least it's not very easy to do so. But there are cases, like, say, neutrons, in which we, at least in principle, can do this. So suppose that we decide to inspect which path each individual atom follows. Then, sure enough, no surprise, each atom does appear to follow either path B or path C. And then the total probability of arriving at E is simply the sum of the probabilities which we measured individually for paths B and path C. That's just a common sense result, no great surprise. What is a surprise, at first sight at least, is the result we get if we choose not to inspect which path is followed. In that case, we find that in general, P sub B or C is not simply the sum of P sub B plus P sub C. In fact, if you do the experiment cleverly, you can actually get the situation that P sub B is non-zero, P sub C is non-zero, but when you open both the paths simultaneously and don't inspect, then P sub B or C is zero, total destructive interference. Now, let me emphasize, so far we've put no interpretation on the data. This is just a statement of the raw data in an interference experiment. What can we reasonably infer from that? Well, prima facie at least, I believe that it's very natural, simply on the basis of this raw experimental data, to conclude that we cannot say that in the absence of inspection, each individual atom followed either path B or path C. Now, what we do say, I think, that's a negative statement. That's one thing we can't say. What can we say positively? Well, I think that's largely a matter of taste. You might want to say each atom follows both path B and path C, follows neither path B nor path C. The whole question is meaningless. But the one thing we can't say, at first sight at least, is that each individual atom follows either path B or path C. If we do, then we have extreme difficulty in explaining why we don't get the common sense result. Now, that's not to say that, of course, as I'm sure you know, there are interpretations of quantum formalism, in particular the Bohm de Broglie pilot wave interpretation, which do claim that you can say this. But then the problem is that in that case, it's not clear what the statement really means, I think, because these interpretations have to invoke something, at least, which it does not accompany the atom on its path. So you have to say the atom itself, the particle, went by one path, but there was a pilot wave which somehow managed to go through both paths or whatever. So it's not entirely clear to me that this really gets you much further, but that's a matter of opinion. Yeah. Yep.
So throughout the term, we've been encouraging the students to just
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, sure, yes, please do. In fact, I'm going to ask at one particular point, I'm going to stop and rather specifically ask for interruptions. Yes?
This is wondering, because what precisely you mean when you say you can't simply go to idle state? Because I know I only get the weird case when I have two slips. So I do know that I don't get this weird thing without inspection. It seems like I know that
it has to do with the two slits, so I know that the photon goes through either one of them somehow. Yeah. But I won't have any problems. I mean, I know that, let's say you have an atom, I know that it doesn't go through the wall or the barrier between the two slits. So yeah. I just want to know how should I think of precisely what you mean when you say.
Well, I think I was deliberately making a negative statement. I mean, I can't tell you how you ought to think of the atom as behaving, or indeed whether you ought to be thinking about it at all. I mean, if I were Niels Bohr, I would tell you, forget about it, basically. There is no picture of what's going on at the microscopic level. I merely want to make to try to persuade you of the plausibility, at least, of the negative statement that the one thing I can't say is that each atom goes one way or the other. As I say, I draw that conclusion on the basis of the raw data without any, at the moment, any interpretation. Okay? However, of course, as you all know, there is a very standard account given by quantum mechanics. All this is terribly elementary stuff, but I think it is worth going through it to motivate what comes later. according to quantum mechanics, if we have a process which can happen by various alternative paths, then the total amplitude for that process to happen is the sum over the amplitudes to go by the possible paths. And the total probability of the event happening is then the square of the total amplitude. Now, in our case, P sub B, remember, was the probability when only path B was open, so the only relevant amplitude in that case is A sub B. P sub B is A sub B squared. Similarly, P sub C is A sub C squared. However, P sub B or C is now given by this expression here, which, of course, we just expand to get this. Now, this we relate to P sub B, this we relate to P sub C, so our conclusion is that what quantum mechanics predicts is that the probability with both paths open is the common sense result plus this crucial extra interference term. And it's in that interference term that the whole mystery of quantum mechanics is often taken to lie. Now, one sort of apparently trivial remark I want to emphasize at this point is that apart from the special case, there is a special case where the product of A star B and AC is pure imaginary when this term, of course, goes away. But that's in some sense a pathological case. Apart from that, it's a necessary and sufficient condition to get non-zero interference effects that the amplitudes A sub B and A sub C for two apparently mutually incompatible paths or behaviours are simultaneously non-zero. Okay? Therefore, it seems legitimate to argue as follows, at the micro level. Remember, we're right now talking about the level of atoms and so forth. If A sub B and A sub C are simultaneously non-zero, then in general, barring this slightly pathological case, in general, this will produce interference, okay, for an isolated system. But we already concluded, on the basis of the raw data, that interference implies no definite choice. It's not true that each atom did one thing or the other. Therefore, combining these two statements, I believe we can legitimately make the draw the conclusion that when, in the quantum mechanical description, A sub B and A sub C are simultaneously non-zero, then it is not. We cannot say that each object, each microscopic object, each atom makes a definite choice of one behaviour or the other. Okay? As I say, what you choose to say positively is your choice, but the one thing we can't say is that. Apparently. Okay, now, so let me just recap that. At the micro level, when A sub B and A sub C are simultaneously non-zero, we apparently have to conclude that neither option B nor option C is actually selected or realized. Now let's follow Schrödinger in his famous 1935 paper and try to extrapolate the formal quantum mechanical description up to the macroscopic everyday level. Now, of course, when we do so, we are implicitly assuming that this is a legitimate exercise. That is, we're assuming that since quantum mechanics appears to describe rather brilliantly the behaviour of objects at the microscopic level, the level of electrons and atoms, and since macroscopic, everyday level objects are composed, presumably, of atoms and electrons, therefore, quantum mechanics should, at least in principle, be capable of describing the behaviour of these macroscopic objects. Okay? We'll come back to that point, but remember, it is an implicit assumption in the Schrödinger's argument. So now what Schrödinger imagines is that I haven't bothered to try to draw the cat, because whenever I try to draw Schrödinger's cat, it ends up looking like a rabbit. So, you all know the setup, basically. So now we have, again, a source of microscopic objects which can travel down either path B or path C. But now we arrange that if, let's just consider the first atom out of the stable, as it were, if that atom definitely goes down path B, then nothing particular happens. We just end up with a state of the universe in which nothing as much has changed, and in particular a cat inside a closed box is alive and well. If, on the other hand, that first atom definitely goes down path C, then it'll go into some kind of counter, which it'll trigger. There'll be all sorts of amplifications and all sorts of exotic things going on. And as a result, the cat will end up dead. And exactly how the cat ends up dead, of course, you have to look in Schrodinger's original paper for them. Anyway, it does. So now, the point of this, of course, is that different microscopic states of, say, the atom have now led to different macroscopic states of the universe as a whole. I don't want to say to different final states of the cat, because I don't want to get into the questions about whether the cat is described by pure state itself or not. It certainly isn't. But anyway, this led to a state of the universe which is macroscopically different in these two cases. Something really, really is different at the everyday level. Now, of course, the point of Schrodinger's thought experiment is that if you believe the standard formulas of quantum mechanics, as we all know and love it, then it's an ineluctable consequence of its linear and unitary nature that if a particular amplitude, A sub B, here, leads under the time evolution operator to a particular macroscopic state of the universe here, and a particular microscopic state A sub C leads to a different macroscopic state of the final state of the universe, then inevitably a superposition of these, that is a state in which both AB and A sub C are non-zero, must inevitably lead to a final state of the universe in which there is a macroscopic amplitudes, psi sub b and psi sub c, are simultaneously non-zero. Okay? And therefore, if we just barge ahead and apply the same principle as we did at the microscopic level, then it looks as if neither macroscopic state is definitely selected. We're not allowed to say that on each occasion we did this experiment. As I always say, it may be fortunate that the animal protection societies have not allowed us to conduct this experiment in statistically significant amounts, but few of us doubt that we could in principle do it. And then it would not be correct to say that each individual cat in this series of experiments ended up definitely alive or definitely dead. That at first sight is the consequence. So this is the what is often called the quantum measurement paradox. I prefer to call it the quantum realization paradox, because really it doesn't have much to do with measurement as such, unless you interpret the word measurement in a very generalized sense. It basically has to do with the prediction, the apparent prediction, that you get simultaneously non-zero amplitudes for macroscopically different states of the world. Okay. Let me now briefly try to review some solutions of the realization paradox. And I think it's convenient to divide these solutions into two classes, depending on whether or not they assume quantum mechanics to be the whole truth about the physical universe. For the moment, let's not worry about conscious observers like ourselves, but let's focus on the physical universe as we normally think of it. I think one can, crudely speaking, there are four types of solution I would distinguish, and I would claim that most of the other ones are in some sense variants of these, though people could disagree about that. At one extreme, you get what I call the statistical, or nowadays the quantum information theoretic, interpretation. This has been espoused by a lot of very distinguished physicists. A fairly well-known article by Ballantyne, for example, in Reviews of Modern Physics way back in 1970, which makes this point, puts this point of view very trenchantly. In more recent years, particularly with the growth of the quantum information field, there have been a lot of people who've espoused this point of view one way or another, one variant or another. And, for example, David Merlin in this this paper does so. And crudely speaking, what that interpretation says is that, look, don't take this too seriously. All that the formalism of quantum mechanics was ever meant to describe was your state of information about the world. In other words, it's just a recipe which enables you to predict what's going to happen at the directly observed macroscopic level, if you like. So, for example, all that, these amplitudes, psi sub b and psi sub c, which occur in the Schrödinger's cat paradox, all that they, their only function is to tell you that your probability of seeing a particular cat to be dead is psi b squared, alive is psi b squared, and dead psi c squared. In other words, the quantum mechanical amplitudes really are just ingredients in a recipe, nothing more, nothing less. They don't correspond to anything, as it were, out there in the physical world, and you shouldn't think of them as doing so, either at the micro level or at the macro level. And I have to say, I think that point of view is internally consistent. After all, incidentally, I think one perhaps could take the point of view that this is just a sort of slight logical development of the traditional Copenhagen point of view, as espoused by particularly by Niels Bohr. And I say, I think one has to say that, as far as anyone knows, this interpretation is internally consistent. Because after all, you know, if you have something, if you have a set of formulae on a piece of paper, and you're told this is simply a recipe, nothing more, nothing less, how could that be inconsistent? Well, the only way it could be inconsistent is if different apparently plausible ways of applying that recipe gave you conflicting results. But I think most people are convinced, and I certainly am, that at least as of now, there is no inconsistency of this type. That is, there's always a, if you think hard about it, there's always a proper way of applying the recipes of quantum mechanics to predict the probabilities of directly observed outcomes. So, and you won't apparently get any contradiction there. So it is internally consistent. I have to say that I find it most uncongenial. Because basically, I think if you really take this point of view seriously, you have to say that there's no point in asking for any kind of description of reality at any level below that of your direct macroscopic observation. Now, it's true that there are variants like the so-called consistent histories approach, which, as it were, try to persuade you that at least in a wide variety of circumstances, our traditional classical ideas about the world do propagate down, as it were, in a considerable way below the level of our direct consciousness. But even they agree that there are circumstances in which this doesn't happen. So, for example, if I've got this cat inside the closed box, I've not taken off the lid to look at her, I think if I really take this interpretation seriously, the question, what is right now the state of this particular cat, is not just unanswerable, it's meaningless. Really. There simply is no reality below the level of what you directly observe. So that seems to me, yeah.
Would say that the question is meaningless. In the cat, for example, I could consider, you know, the story that the cat is alive, and then maybe later we're going to play with some string. But you know, it's about, you know, making up stories or descriptions of reality, like you said.
Yeah.
But just the state, the wave function, happens to be about our information, and you could.
Well, okay. If you, I mean, if you're saying that the advocates of this interpretation would claim that the answer to what is the state of the cat is it is in a described by a linear superposition, these two amplitudes, then I would agree. But that's not what I think most people, as it were, at the everyday level, would think of as the state of the cat. Yep.
Ballantyne, I think, advocated the view as this is how we should interpret quantum mechanics,
yeah.
And with fully in mind the idea that it's consistent with some underlying hidden variable description of reality,
yes.
Although it was non-committal as to which invariable theory that would be, whether it be von de Broglie or some other yet to be discovered, or Nelson's stochastic dynamics. So I think it's, at least in Ballantyne's view, was consistent with there being some underlying reality, but just not to attribute reality to the state itself was the idea.
So the quantum state then is, it describes your state of information, but there may be some other description or some other essence below that. Yeah, that's a That is a possibility, certainly. I think I would use the arguments which I gave earlier in the microscopic context to explain why I don't find that particularly congenial. I mean, it seems that you, for example, if you take bone de Broglie, you can get away with the statement that each atom did definitely do one thing or the other, but at a big cost, a big price. You've got to be prepared for then to be this amplitude, which somehow is associated with the other possibility.
This emphasis that, well, because the state is also a real object, the pilot wave,
yes,
the de Broglie bone theory, yes, that it is going through the other slit. So in some sense,
yes,
you can have your cake and eat it too. But I think it's an open issue as to whether it's possible to construct a hidden variable theory underlying quantum mechanics in which the state doesn't play an ontic role. You would just have, I agree with you that in the Bohmian case you have this problem, but I think it's an open issue as to whether it would be conceivable that we could construct such a hidden variable theory that wouldn't have that feature.
I think possibly some of the things I'm going to say in the second lecture may be relevant to that, because I'll look specifically at how we can or cannot interpret the formalism at the macroscopic level. So that won't come back then. Yep. Okay, so as I say, I don't like it. You're welcome to like it. I always say, if someone were to come back, if a time traveler were to come back from the year 3000 or 5000 and tell me that in that far, far distant future, people are still believing that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the physical world and ask me how I react, I think I would have to fall back on this point of view. But as I say, I don't find it very congenial, and I strongly suspect, actually, that most of my experimental colleagues don't find it terribly congenial either. They'd like to, in some sense, think that their experiments are dealing with the real world, in a sense which, at least at first sight, this interpretation seems to exclude. Okay, so let's now go over to the other extreme. You remember that the statistical interpretation says don't take the formalism of quantum mechanics too seriously. At the other extreme, we have the so-called many-worlds, relative state, Everett Wheeler interpretation, which says, no, by all means, take the formalism of quantum mechanics deadly seriously. It really does. These amplitudes really do correspond to physical reality, not just at the micro level, but also at the macro level. Okay, so how do they cope with the Schrödinger's cat situation? Well, sure enough, there is a, as it were, a branch of the world in which the cat is alive, and another branch in which she's dead. And now I say, well, wait a minute, I just took the lid off the box, and this particular cat seems to me to be sitting up and alive and well. What happened to the part of the quantum mechanical amplitude which described her as being dead? To which, of course, the advocates of this interpretation will say, what you have to understand is that there is a parallel universe which is equally real to the one you think you observe, in which not only is this particular cat dead, but you are observing her to be dead, and all your friends agree that she is dead, etc., etc., etc. And there are all sorts of formal theorems which say, yeah, I can never be aware of this, this parallel universe. Now, how many of you actually would say that you believe this interpretation? Oh, well, I don't have to go.
In fairness, I don't think Lev would agree with what you just characterized his interpretation as.
Okay.
This is Okay.
Do you put it in a nutshell?
Oh, I'd like to hear that. I don't think I could put it in a nutshell effectively, but I can say it's definitely not what you just said. although I do think you accurately characterized Everett's many worlds, which is a sort of a sheep of a different color.
So this is a problem. Of course, as I'm sure you realise by now, this is a endemic problem with any discussion of the foundations of quantum mechanics. That you find that there are infinite varieties of interpretation, and sometimes one interpretation tends to morph into another. So we'd have to have Lev here, I guess, to discuss this problem. Okay, so I won't give my my thought experiment, since apparently no one, or not too many people, need convincing. I'd like to mention, briefly at least, one further, third class of interpretations, which is not a, a mainstream one, I think, but I think perhaps needs to be taken a little more seriously than it it tends to be. And somewhat related to some ideas of Shulman, which is written in this paper. Basically, it has to do with questioning our normal assumptions about the arrow of time, or the arrow of causality, rather than taking the view that it's my initial actions, my preparation of a particular quantum state at some initial time, which then leads with certain probability to outcomes at a final time. This one tries to turn it around. And well, maybe what we should do is to say, look, in some sense, when we actually finished performing the experiment, it is a fact that, for example, this particular cat ended up dead. So. Now, it's always possible formally to write down an initial state of the universe which will lead to that unique final state. And so are there some constraints we can put on this kind of speculation? The most obvious, I think, sort of feeling of discomfort one gets with this is that it looks at first sight, at least, as if any idea of this type is going to be highly incompatible with the second law of thermodynamics. I think actually that's a much more tricky question than often given credit for. I think most people would agree that the notion that the future causes, the past causes the present and the future, not vice versa, no basis for that in Newtonian mechanics, no basis either in quantum mechanics if you formulate it properly, as, for example, Hermanoff, Bergmann, and Leibniz did in their 64 paper. So the question is there any sense in which you can get out of some of these difficulties by assuming that there's a definite event in the future which then propagated back to affect conditions at the present? That's all very vague and so forth, and so I don't think it's been explored as much as it could be. Shulman has a particular version of this which I call the Calvinistic interpretation, because it essentially seems for an facio to deny free will to the experimenter. So it has to start off with this peculiar state which is uniquely guaranteed to lead to the final outcome. Sort of, yes. I found, this is Kramer, right? I found that a little difficult to put flesh on. I mean, I read the words, and I'm not quite sure that I know how to interpret them. But it is, yeah. I mean, I think this idea has occurred to a number of people. I mean, certainly to Cosmo Beauregard, certainly Kramer, Hugh Price, Toft, others, and so forth. But as I say, it's very difficult I find it very, very difficult to make anything concrete out of this. So I'll just briefly mention that. I think it does deserve a mention. Finally, we come to the last of the solutions, which are based on the hypothesis of the universal validity of quantum mechanics, which is what I call the orthodox or decoherence resolution. I think this is a kind of view which a lot of practicing physicists who may have come to this problem independently, they tend to come up with this kind of solution. It's been energetically propagated by Zurek and others. Here's a typical paper of his on it. And let me just remind you about the phenomenon of decoherence. Let's divide the universe, meaning everything I'm interested in, basically, anything that may have an effect, into the system we're primarily interested in, S, the environment, E. And then, crudely speaking, the idea of decoherence is that we can start off with a quantum superposition of states of the system. And just to keep our bookkeeping straight, we introduce also a state of the environment, but that is independent of the state of the system. So it's not at this moment it's not entangled with the state of the system. It's just a fixed state. If we now work out the density matrix, the reduced density matrix of the system. We don't even have to reduce it. It has this familiar form here with non-zero off-diagonal elements here. Then the idea is that as a result of the system-environment interaction and the working of the unitary operator associated with it, this initial state evolves into an entangled state of the system and the environment where, at least under appropriate circumstances, the two states, x1 and x2, of the environment associated with psi 1 and psi 2 are pretty much orthogonal. Then, once we've done that, then the density matrix of the system, which, remember, we have to obtain by tracing the density matrix of the universe over the environment, then by standard arguments, that comes out to be this form here with zeros on the off-diagonal. And then you find that if you can now only conduct your measurements on the system and not on the environment, then all predictions for outcomes of these measurements are exactly as if state 1 or state 2 were realized with probability alpha squared or beta squared, respectively. That's just what I earlier called, essentially, in the context of the Young-Slitz experiment, I called it a common sense result. Well, so far so good. I don't really have any problem with the argument so far. However, the crucial step, which often is not even stated explicitly in the papers on the subject, is often simply swept under the rug, the crucial step is that since predictions for all possible the results of all possible experiments on the system are identical to the common sense result, that is, the result you would get if each system were doing one thing or the other, therefore you can legitimately say that each individual system does indeed actually realize either state 1 or state 2. So in the Schrodinger's cat example, crudely speaking, you know you're never going to be able to detect any interference between the living and dead states of the cat. Therefore, you can legitimately say each particular cat is either alive or dead long before I actually take the lid off the box and observe them. Okay? I have very grave problems with that point of view. My first objection is one which was given, John Bell used to make, I think, quite consistently. How do you know, as it were? How do you know that you'll never be able to see interference between the living and dead states of the cat? I mean, there have been many, many occasions in the history of physics when people have said, you will never see this, you'll never be able to see this phenomenon, and then technology has improved to the point where you can see it. And we'll see some examples of that, actually, in the next lecture. So it really seems rather unsatisfactory that one's interpretation of the meaning of the quantum formalism has to depend on the current state of technology. However, I think there's actually something much worse than that, and this is an objection which, as far as I know, Bell himself never really made, but I think it still is a substantial objection. I think this argument does involve a gross logical fallacy. At the microscopic level, we concluded that there was a certain interpretation of the quantum formalism which we could not make, namely that each atom does one thing or the other. What was our evidence for drawing that conclusion? The evidence was the phenomenon of interference. Now, everyone agrees that by the time we get up from the level of the atom to the level of the cat, the evidence in the form of interference has gone away. We're never going to be. I mean, let's agree, for the sake of argument, that we're never practically going to be able to see interference between the living and dead states of the cat. Does that mean that we are entitled to grossly reinterpret the meaning of the quantum mechanical formalism? I believe no. The fact that I think that the standard decoherence argument grossly confuses the question of the meaning of the quantum formalism with the question of the evidence that meaning, that assignment of meaning is correct. Okay. Perhaps at this stage I should just stop for a moment and ask if, I won't ask if you're convinced, but I've tried to make the case that we should be worried, basically. That is, we should be worried about the assumption that quantum mechanics is going to turn out to be a complete description of the physical world. And so we might have to live with it, conceivably. I don't exclude it, but I think that the sort of considerations I've gone through are sufficient motivation for exploring an alternative point of view. Any questions or comments on that? Yes.
I don't see it immediately, but where would the de Broglie bone fit into these four sort of categories?
Well, then I think that depends on how you interpret the words, as it were. And in particular, whether you, in the usual language, whether you interpret the pilot wave as having an ontic or Millian epistemic significance. If you interpret it as having an epistemic significance, then I think you'd have to say it's on the what I call the quantum information side. If you interpret it as an ontic, then it's more like many worlds. Really. So, as I say, things always morph into one another. Yeah.
So, you've convinced me, or I guess I was already convinced of this, that if we take a quantum mechanics seriously as the way the world is, then either we have to accept that there's something very strange going on with how we make probabilistic statements about reality, or that we have an entirely non-local theory. So my question to you then is it your view that if we were to find a deeper theory or an alternative description of reality that wasn't quantum mechanics, we would be able to remove one or both of those characters from that deeper theory? Like is it your picture that we might yet find a deeper theory which actually resolves the non-local character of quantum mechanics?
Well, okay, so far I haven't explicitly, of course, relied on any arguments concerning local currency. I agree that in order to exclude certain classes of hidden variable theory, I would have to do that. If you want my best guess, actually, I don't think that the final solution is going to come rejection of locality. I think it's much more likely to come by rejection of the arrow of time. I mean, something I think I'm actually rather convinced that there is a deep problem with the arrow of time that we don't understand at present. If you ask me, you know, in which direction does the solution lie? Well, you know, if I knew that, I'd be doing it. But I think my instinct is that's where it's going.
In quantum mechanics, we sort of treat time, sort of we put it to the side. Do you think we should be focusing on that time rate, like what time actually is, what it means, or is it sort of all?
Trouble is, if we, for the moment, forget about the sort of considerations which might come out of a final theory of quantum gravity or anything like that, and just stick to, as it were, physics as performed in the laboratory at the everyday level, time is such a basic ingredient in setting up, as it were, the scheme in the first place, that I find it very difficult to analyse it further. But maybe that's precisely what we should be doing.
It's likely that there's something I missed. This is a very naive question, but is there any merit to the idea that the wave function of whatever path and degree of freedom has been used to fire the detector, you know, collapses when the detector fires, killing off the mechanics, so that what you end up with, you know, is a mistake? Is that what this is? Or? That cascade that takes you from, you know, the path three of freedom of a neutron slits to a dead cat. Is there not an implicit wave function collapsing there that would have solved that specifically?
Lots of people try to find it and fail. I think there are very strong arguments that the formalism of quantum mechanics itself cannot give you such a collapse. Now, we'll come in a moment to alternative theories, which do, but within the framework of quantum mechanics, there's nothing particularly magic about cascade processes involving many electrons. You can still apply the language of quantum superpositions to it, and so on and so forth. Of course, it does have a very severe practical consequence that the moment you're, let's say your neutron has gone into some counter and set off a chain of reactions, it's extremely unlikely you're going to be able to exhibit any future interference. But that's, so as John Bellowes used to say, FAP for all practical purposes. You can make your predictions by saying that by this time one state or one outcome or the other has been definitely realized. But it doesn't answer the, as far as I can see, the conceptual question. Yep.
Your point of view a bit.
Yep.
So I spent some time describing what I, you know, quotes from Einstein, yep, the meaning of the course. A lot of things you said are very similar to what, or his point of view, that quantum mechanics probably isn't the whole story. We need some deeper theory.
Yes.
With the exception of calling the statistical interpretation an extension of Bohr's view. So I don't know if you agree with that. But are you familiar with his writings on Einstein's? Yeah.
Not necessarily.
But do you think of the way you're thinking as being similar to his, or is there some ways you distance yourself from his point of view?
I think Einstein was much more, I don't want to say obsessed, but he was much more motivated than I am by a belief in determinism. I would like to believe in determinacy. I don't have any particular fondness for determinism. Okay, let me just try to make that distinction, because it's one I think which sometimes is missed. Determinism would be the claim that the outcome of each particular experiment, let us say the Schrodinger's cat type, the difference, the outcome of each particular experiment is uniquely determined by conditions at an earlier point in time. Determinacy says that the state of each system at any particular point in time is definite, in the sense that the cat is definitely alive or dead. You can perfectly well, it seems to me, embrace determinacy without embracing determinism. And as I say, I think Einstein's main motivation was determinism, at least as I read it.
What we're saying on this is, in quantum mechanics, we have a wave function, we know how to calculate it from time 1 to time 2, and this is what we would call determinacy. If Psi really described the state of the system.
Well, if I believe in many worlds interpretation, then of course I suppose I would say that, well, the state of the system is nothing but the quantum mechanical state. I don't want to do that, and therefore I want, as it were, to maintain determinacy in the everyday kind of sense.
Objects have well-defined properties.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily cause and determine those properties at a later time.
Exactly. Yeah.
Would you say that this P BC not equal to P A or P B plus P C, is that violating logic or usual rules of logic?
No. I don't think it's violating our usual rules of logic at all.
Well, our usual rules of probability, then, or?
It's a statement about the raw experimental data. I don't quite see how a statement about actually observed experimental data, I certainly don't see how they could violate the laws of logic. I don't really see how they can violate the laws of probability, either.
I'm surprised by the question too. With somebody in the course, I can't remember who, pointed out that if you keep track of the conditionals and those probabilities, the probabilities are conditioned on the same conditional
Yes.
Then you can say certain things about how they relate to each other, but because you're changing the facts of the experiment,
that's right. Yes.
Closing a slit, opening a slit, logic says nothing about how those objects relate to each other.
Yeah, that, exactly, yes. And in fact, Niels Bohr made this point, I think, very strongly. He made the point that you can't even really attribute properties to microscopic objects such as electrons or neutrons without initially prepared to specify the macroscopic apparatus which then be interacting with.
But, I mean, presumably, why else would you write down P not equal to these other P's if you weren't suggesting that it's somehow surprising? I'm asking, like, you're saying that, okay, so maybe there's a problem with time, say, maybe there's a problem with what causes what. Now, you can think of a sort of Schrodinger-like extrapolation up to our level.
Yeah.
Should that mean we should pardon all criminals because we don't know whether their actions actually cause, someone else to die, or?
Well, okay.
I mean, isn't there?
That's actually the point I was going to bring up later, a rather different question, but, or something close to related to that.
I think one has, as it were, rightly or wrongly, got a picture of the way that the world operates at the macroscopic level, which we're used to. Schrodinger's thought experiment appears to be telling us that at least in certain circumstances, things don't operate in that way, even at the macroscopic level, or might not. And we'll come in the next lecture to some experiments which appear to be consistent with that. So I think I would regard it as surprising. The P sub B or C not equal to P sub B plus PC is not in contradiction with any principle of logic. I don't believe it's in contradiction with any principle of probability theory. It's very surprising. Okay, so if I've persuaded you that at least we might have some motivation for considering a different point of view, let's go to the other class of alleged resolutions of the quantum measurement or quantum realization problem, which are basically those which assume that quantum mechanics breaks down at some point en route from the atom to the cat, not for the moment said what point. Okay? Now, I think you've probably at least met GRWP, Gerardi Romani Weber Pearl theory. In that scenario, you have a universal noise background, which is not itself quantum mechanical. That's absolutely fundamental. The moment you allow that noise background to be itself described by quantum mechanics, you're back to square one. So you've got to treat it as non-quantum mechanical. That noise background will interact with the system. Technically, it introduces a nonlinear term into the Schrodinger equation. And by doing so, it will induce a continuous stochastic evolution to one or other of the states of a superposition. And that's, within the GRWP scenario, that's a very general, a very generic phenomenon. However, there are, as it were, certain conditions needed to make this a spectacular effect. First of all, according to the current version of the theory, you need, in some sense, a trigger for this reduction to take place. And the trigger has to be, according to them, a large separation, large meaning greater than, say, 1,000 angstroms, a large separation of the center of mass of some number n of particles in the two branches of your superposition. And at least in the current version of the theory, which, I have to take because, they've spent a lot of work on it and this is the only concrete version we have right now, in this current version of the theory, it is the center of mass and the different behavior in two branches of the superposition which play a fundamental role. I think what is very interesting and in some sense rather convincing about the GRWP theory is that suppose that you do, in fact, have a... suppose quantum mechanics does describe the situation by a superposition of two branches in which n particles are behaving appreciably differently with respect to their center of mass. Okay? Then it turns out that quite automatically, this does not, let me emphasize, this does not have to be built in by hand. It comes out quite automatically from the general formulation of the theory that the rate at which you get an evolution from the superposition to one or other of its branches is proportional to the number of particles but behaving differently. That, you see, is really a very nice feature. Because what it means is something like this. There are lots and lots of phenomena at the atomic and microscopic level where standard quantum mechanics seems to work just fine. Imagine, for example, that we have do the following experiment. I doubt whether it's been done, but there isn't really, it shouldn't. Let's imagine that we have a photon which is coming from the most distant quasar currently visible in the galaxy, in the universe. And we're going to put that photon through the arms of a Michelson interferometer and look for interference states. I think few of us doubt that experiment is likely to give the standard results as predicted by quantum mechanics. As I say, I'm not sure it's actually being done, but other experiments are not so different, which have. Now, that photon has actually been on the road for billions of years, and the two pods in question are certainly much more than 1,000 angstroms apart. They could be 100 meters. Nevertheless, if you fix the numbers, the two characteristic numbers that go into GRWP, if you fix them right, then that will guarantee you that essentially this collapse process, if you want to call it that, has no effect. So basically, quantum mechanics still works just fine. On the other hand, think about Schrödinger's cat. How many atoms are behaving differently depending on whether she's alive or dead? Well, you know, by the simplest argument, something like 10 to the 30. So the rate of evolution of that superposition to one of its branches is something like 10 to the 30th times as fast as that of the single photon, one of its branches. So that means that you can perfectly well, if you fix the parameters right, you can perfectly well preserve all the predictions of quantum mechanics, which we know and love, at the microscopic atomic level. Nevertheless, you can obtain the result that the superposition of living and dead cat states evolves to one or the other of these two states in a time which is far, far smaller than any conceivable time of human observation. So I think that's a large part of the motivation for GRWP. Of course, it is necessary that in a typical measurement situation, the theory makes statistical predictions identical to those of standard quantum mechanics, and indeed it does. It's fixed up, so it does. So. Now, there are questions. There are questions raised about whether you can, whether GRWP is entirely consistent at the relativistic level. The answer to those questions, I believe, depends on whether you are about how seriously you want to take special relativity. That is, it depends on whether you merely want to preserve Einstein locality, or whether, in addition, you require Lorentz invariance. There are some highly technical points there. But at least I think everyone, independently of that, I think everyone agrees that at the non-relativistic level, GRWP is, in fact, entirely self-consistent. Okay? Whether it's right, of course, is a totally different matter. We'll sort of come back to that. And there are other... yeah?
Where does the non-quantum mechanical noise background come from?
Well, that's a basic assumption of the theory. I mean, it's one of those questions you're not supposed to ask. You possibly.
So I have two kind of problems with this, or reservations. One, a universal non-quantum mechanical noise background just sounds like more ether, which we don't have good luck with those kind of ideas. And two, so we're saying that so for a system with like a large number of particles, then you have this stochastic evolution to one of these possible states of superposition. But so that's if we're looking outside of this cat in the box, then this will tell us, okay, I guess I'm trying to figure out what exactly it's telling us, because it's like what the cat inside the box itself will be in a superposition for an incredibly small amount of time and then collapse to one of its definite states.
Yeah.
I mean, from the point of view of the cat, that doesn't make any sense. If the cat's sitting in the box, then it, that it would or maybe that's an assumption about reality.
Let's bring this up a little by going from Schrödinger's cat to Wigner's friend. I guess you may know Wigner's friend development of that. It's basically a slightly expanded version of the Schrödinger's cat paradox, in which you replace the cat by a very trustworthy friend. And, then you, and of course the point now, and of course you don't kill them, so in other words, we're not at the point of the experiment, arrange to either give him or not give him a small electric shock, let's say. And of course if you follow Schrödinger's argument, then your friend is just part of the physical world, your quantum mechanical description of him is by a superposition of states of having received and not having received the shock, but few of us doubt that when you open the door of the box and let him out, he will tell you, yes, I did or no, I didn't. So
the same thing I guess the same comment in this case is like, so for a very short time, yeah, with Ignorance Friend is in a superposition of shocked and non-shocked, and then what if that time was, well, I don't want to take this too far, but that just doesn't seem, that doesn't sit well with me.
I think it wouldn't sit well with me if it were to indicate that you would predict, and I don't quite know how to put this, if you were to predict that the friend actually, in some sense, experience is being in a superposition, but that would clearly depend on the actual parameters of the theory. I mean, if the realization takes place before the physiological processes in speculative have time to be transmitted to the realm of part of the brain, then presumably that problem doesn't arise.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, what if the time scale was large, but then we can talk about that forever.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, there are, incidentally, there will be all sorts of using thought experiments one can do along these lines. I've actually, from time to time, I try to conspire with a colleague in experimental psychology at the University of Illinois to do just a sort of first step along this road. so this is, the DRW,
is there a compelling reason for choosing the position representation as like a preferred basis?
That's a very, very good question.
We have something similar with, you know, momenta as a trigger.
No, that's a very good question. In fact, GRWP do quite explicitly say that they are in some sense putting primacy on the position representation. Now, there are some arguments in the literature by people like Ludwig Broglie as to why claiming that position representation is in some sense the representation of last resort. And I think these are usually based on the idea that our primary perceptions as human beings, our primary perceptions are position. I'm not actually totally sure that those are very convincing. I think if you ask experimental psychologists these days, they might well tell you that we have at least as primary perception of velocity as we do in position. So I think that is a question mark over the, if you like, about the a priori plausibility of GRWP. Yeah. I think what is, to me, the more disturbing is that it's only the centre of mass and the distribution of mass which is taken to Rome, but not, for example, the distribution of electric charge, for example, or electric currents. And as we'll see, unfortunately, many of the most interesting experiments in the last 10 years have dealt with cases where there's no displacement, principle of displacement in the central mass. Therefore, don't bite on the GRWP side. Okay, so other. I better speed up, I guess. So I have to finish by 3:15, roughly. Yeah, okay. So I think. Let me go ahead and ask. Okay, we've now got two classes of hypotheses. One is that quantum mechanics is the whole truth about the physical world, and we have to try to interpret it. Other hypothesis is that something else comes in at some level between the atom and the cat. So now we raise the question, is it possible to discriminate experimentally between these hypotheses A and B? And if you think about it, I think it's fairly obvious that the answer is we can do it, we can discriminate experimentally, if and only if we can observe quantum interference on macroscopically distinct states. I'll abbreviate that from now on as QINDS. Okay? Why? Well, if there's no possibility of ever observing quantum interference between two states which are by some reasonable criterion macroscopically distinct, then by definition, all results are going to be identical to those which we would have got by assuming that one outcome or the other was definitely realized. That's just the usual statement of decoherence theory. Right? So in that case, if that were really to be the case, then there'd simply be no way of knowing experimentally whether quantum mechanics was indeed the whole truth or not. So we've got to be able to see QIMDS. Now, of course, at this point, people always raise legitimately the question, what's an appropriate measure of macroscopicness, if you like, Schrodinger's cattiness, of a particular kind of quantum superposition. And actually, I think really probably too much energy has been spent on that particular question. People get very worked up about it. I don't think 50 years from now it's going to be seen to matter very much how we chose our exact definitions. It's basically we want to motivate a program. And the precise figure of merit, as it were, we prescribe for that program doesn't seem to be terribly important. The one thing I would say, though, is that you don't want to make to define macroscopically distinct in such a way that the non-existence of QIMDS becomes tautology. And I say that because there is a class, a rather small class, admittedly, but a class of very irritating papers in the literature where the author has, at some stage or other, argued that you will never see, you'll never be able to see quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. Then you bring up one of the cases I'm going to bring up in the next lecture, and then he comes back with, well, the fact that you saw interference shows that the states could not have been macroscopically distinct, which seems to be complete nonsense. I mean, that's really a very, very irritating kind of argument, so we don't want to do that. So we have to find some kind of rough and ready criteria, just to know roughly in which direction we're looking. Right? So I think my proposed measures would be, first of all, the difference in expectation value of one or more extensive physical quantities in the two branches should be large in some kind of natural atomic units. Okay? Now, unfortunately, by itself, that doesn't seem adequate, apparently, because, after all, if you think about the neutron interferometer, the two beams are split apart at some stage by something like 30 centimeters. If you convert that into atomic units, well, what's a typical atomic unit of length? Maybe the Bohr radius or something like that. It comes out to be something like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10. But I don't think that most of us would think of the neutron interferometer as an example of quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states. It doesn't have, as it were, the Schrodinger's cat aspect to it. So I think you do want to supplement that. And my own attempt at supplementing it was to introduce some... this was back in 1980, the idea of so-called disconnectivity. I think, in retrospect, that can be seen as a rather early and fudged attempt to define the concept of many-particle entanglement. But basically, I was trying to ask how many elementary objects are behaving appreciably differently in the two branches. Then, of course, again, one can always argue what you count as elementary objects. I'm going to be very Johnsonian about that. I'm just going to say I believe, for these purposes of this argument, I believe that protons, neutrons, and electrons are elementary objects. And if you come back and tell me they're all made of quarks, well, that's your choice. but just to have a concrete definition, let's assume that. Yeah, well, right. Yeah. But you do have to worry about gluons and so forth. Yeah. Okay. So this is what we want to look for. Can we see quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states? And that's basically been the motivation, or at least part of the motivation, for the program whose output I'll describe in the next lecture. I think I'll skip the next three view graphs, otherwise I'm not going to finish on time. I do have some comments, if anyone wants to ask me about them afterwards, about whether existing, by which I mean existing prior to 2000, roughly, existing systems like, say, QED cavities and Cooper pair boxes, whether they already have a high degree of disconnectivity. I mean, the answer is no, but it's not a trivial point. A second question I won't have time to discuss today, I think, is can one say that the Bell EPR experiments already exclude macrorealism? Macrorealism, by the way, I don't think I mentioned this, but I'm going to basically talk about a class of theories of which GRWP is a special case. They're theories which basically, in some sense, build in some kind of physical collapse into the wave function so that superposition is reduced into one of its branches by the time you get to the macroscopic level. And I won't worry about whether it's specifically GRWP or something a bit different. Okay, so let's try to formulate a program here. I would like to, yes, I'll try to get this across because I think this is really rather important. So let's try to envisage a program now. Let's first of all try to make circumstantial tests of the applicability of quantum mechanics to macroscopic variables. Secondly, that's stage one, Stage two is to try to observe or not QIMDS given a quantum mechanical interpretation of the raw data. In other words, can we say that given a quantum mechanical interpretation of the raw data, we are seeing not a mixture but a superposition, quantum superposition of two macroscopically distinct states? Stage three is more ambitious. We would either like to exclude hypothesis B, which remember is macrorealism, independently of the interpretation of the raw data, or possibly exclude hypothesis A, that is the universal validity of quantum mechanics, at, of course, a particular level. We have to specify the level at which we're going to do this. Now, I and a few other people started to sort of propagandize for this program way back about 1980, and we got lots and lots of flack, particularly from the traditional quantum measurement community. And the first bit of flack we got is that if you're dealing with a macroscopic variable, like, say, the current of a squid ring, that's an example I'll use in the next lecture, then the action, in the technical sense of classical mechanics, is large compared to h-bar, and that means that the predictions of quantum mechanics are indistinguishable, going to be indistinguishable from those of classical mechanics. Actually, that's not true, but it's an oversimplification. But there is something to this objection. You do, generally speaking, you do want your action not to be large in units of h-bar. So what does that mean? Well, that means what you've got to do is to find a macroscopic variable whose motion is controlled by a microscopic energy. And you might think that's very improbable, but it turns out these are actually rather plentiful actually, such cases. We'll see some in the next lecture. Second objection we got is that decoherence would make stage two impossible in practice. In other words, you are never going to be able to see quantum interference of macroscopically distinct states because decoherence is always guaranteed to come in until you stand dead. And in fact, I'm told that even as late as 1999, when Hans Moyer was setting up one of the first experiments of the type I'll describe in the next lecture, a distinguished colleague of his, who was an expert or regarded himself as an expert in quantum foundations, assured him with great confidence that he was wasting the taxpayers' money. This experiment was never going to work. Well, we'll see. It did work. So I think that one is knocked out. Yeah.
What's puzzling about this is, I mean, with the dissipation and decoherence, it's not. I mean, you can identify sources that are affecting your system, but often you have unidentified sources.
Okay.
And how would you distinguish collapse from unidentified sources?
Yeah, thank you for that's a very good question, because there have actually been papers published in the literature saying, look, there is no way we're ever going to believe that quantum mechanics has broken down, because if we fail to see quantum interference or macroscopically distinct states where we expected to see it, then we will simply attribute it to some unknown source of decoherence. I think that's a bit like these theories which attempted to explain the precession of the perihelion of Mercury by saying that maybe the exponent of the Coulomb force is not 2 but 1.99999. In other words, you can try this for a certain while, but when you've actually tried to find physically these extra sources of decoherence, and you've tried for a certain number of years and failed to find them, then I think most people would become rather convinced that this is not a plausible idea. You'd have to be very, very strongly wedded to a belief in the universality of quantum mechanics, I think.
Variety of experiments in different setups, where one experiment determined the parameters in the GRWP scheme.
Yeah.
And when you found that effect happening at the same parameter values in different systems, then you would get some kind of evidence that this is a universal.
I think that would certainly be rather convincing. The third objection, I think, really is rather serious. It does require meeting explicitly as far as one can. People point out that the experiments I'm going to be talking about in the next lecture are not on nice, cleanly defined systems like sodium atoms or anything like that. I mean, a sodium atom is, as far as we know, a sodium atom. It has a definite mass, it has a definite spin, etc., etc. All sodium atoms have exactly the same properties. We think we know their Hamiltonian pretty well, etc. You know, that's not going to be the case at all with some of these systems I'm talking about. They're going to be messy bits of metal sitting on a lab bench. We certainly don't know their exact chemical composition. We don't know where the dislocations are exactly. they're interacting with the black body radiation field, with the vibrations of the lab bench, you know. So it's a horribly messy situation. And so it's often claimed that if you were to do an experiment with any system you could reasonably describe as macroscopic or involving interference of macroscopic and distinct states, and you were to see a result which is prima facie in contradiction with quantum mechanics, people claim they are not going to believe this, because they will say, well, you simply didn't get your initial Hamiltonian right, and so forth. Now, if one in fact had to rely on some kind of a priori knowledge of the Hamiltonian, I think this would be a very strong objection. However, it turns out very interestingly, there is a way of fighting it. If you, rather than starting from a microscopic Hamiltonian and from that deriving the quantum behavior and then perhaps an appropriate limit of the classical behavior, that is the green arrows, why don't we try the following? Let's start by actually doing experiments in the classical regime, that is the regime where everyone agrees that quantum mechanics, predictions of quantum mechanics basically reduced of classical mechanics. Let's see whether we can get enough information from that about the microscopic Hamiltonian to then predict with some confidence the quantum behavior. It doesn't mean we have to get the whole of the Hamiltonian, it turns out. Partial information may be enough. How does that work in detail? I think I'm trying to finish with this one. How in detail might we try to infer the quantum behavior from the classical? Now, I have to say, this is a messy topic and is not completely resolved, but there has been a fair amount of work on it in the last 3 decades. Rather than generally, we can say the Hamiltonian of interest is going to consist of, trivially, a Hamiltonian of the system, one for the environment, and then some system-environment interaction. Now, there's a very important principle here. Let's imagine that the motion of the system only perturbs any one degree of freedom of the environment only weakly. Then there's a rather strong argument, not 100% rigorous, but there's a strong argument that you can model the environment Hamiltonian and the system-environment interaction in the following way. This is actually, if you want a definite reference for this, it's done in an absolutely unreadable appendix to a long paper I wrote with Amir Caldera in 1983. You can model the environment by simply a set of simple harmonic oscillators. Okay? Now, you might think that was very improbable at first sight. After all, most environments are nothing like a set of simple harmonic oscillators. However, think back. To the 19th century, when people were doing lots and lots of experiments in optics, but they hadn't any idea about the constitution of the atom. There was a very widely used model of the atom in those days, which precisely looked at it as a collection of harmonic oscillators. And it was so successful, in fact, that much of the terminology has continued into the 21st century. We still talk about oscillator strengths and so forth, okay? Even though we now know that the atom is nothing like a set of harmonic oscillators. So why could they get away with that? The reason they could get away with it is they didn't have lasers in those days. So whenever you shot a beam of, say, thermal light into a gas, okay, the beam itself might be almost completely absorbed, but any one atom was only very, very weakly perturbed by it. So only one degree of freedom was only weakly excited. And there's a very general argument, which we try to sketch in this paper, that this will always be the case, a similar situation, whenever any one degree of freedom of the environment is only weakly excited by the motion of the system, which still allows the environment to have a huge effect on the motion of the system as a whole. Right? So you model the environment by harmonic oscillators, and again, rather general arguments that you can model the system-environment interaction in this way where x alpha is the oscillator coordinate. Now, one can often go a bit further than that, because often one does have some a priori knowledge about the nature of the variables you're talking about. For example, is the Hamiltonian time reversal invariant or not? That's something you can say without a great deal of detailed knowledge about the system. And under rather widespread conditions, you can argue that f alpha of q is just given by this rather simple form here, plus the so-called counter term, which as a technical matter I won't discuss unless anyone's particularly interested. Given this, then, with this form of f, it turns out you can define a so-called spectral density of the system environment coupling, which is given by this expression here. It involves the C alphas, N alpha, and G alpha. And well, the nice thing is that J of omega will then uniquely determine both the classical and the quantum response. And I'll go through that in some detail in this paper here. And example, let's take a current biased Jesison junction. A current flowing through your junction, and you're going to shunt this junction with some kind of generalized impedance. And what you can do in that situation, and what has been done in fact, is to determine the form of K of omega by doing experiments in the classical limit. And then, so that from that, you can set, turns out you can set J of omega is the imaginary part of K of omega. You then input this form of J of omega, which you got experimentally, remember, into a calculation of, for example, the quantum tunneling out of the zero voltage state. And that actually turns out to work really rather well. It's been tested by some beautiful experiments by John Clark's group in the mid-80s. And there, since then, there have been some very amusing subsequent developments. For example, there's been a beautiful experiment by the Saclay group in which they took their Josephson junction, they shunted it with a variable, with an absorbing stopper, which they can move away and back along a waveguide perpendicular to the junction. And they found, very amusingly, they found that when the time taken by a light signal or an electrical signal to get out to the point of the absorbing lock was much shorter than the characteristic attempt frequency, they found it had a big effect. When they moved it further away, it had no effect. And that's exactly what's predicted in detail by the theory. So there's a beautiful agreement between theory and experiment in that. So I think one can say then that at least as regards a sort of rather restricted class of systems, namely Josephson devices, this program has worked really rather well. That is, we have been able to make quite parameter-free predictions of things like tunneling rates. They have come out in agreement with experiment. So that, I think, should give us a fair amount of confidence that with appropriate reservations, this general program does work. And if one were ever to come up with an experiment which did not appear to give agreement with the predictions of quantum mechanics, then I think that has to be that would have to be taken into account very seriously. In other words, we're much better off than you might think at first sight in making quantum I won't say rigorous but highly plausible quantum mechanical predictions for realistic many-body kinematic systems. This is something that is very difficult to persuade people who come from, say, atomic or particle physics about, because they just have this sort of dirt physics complex about condensed matter. But you have to look at the evidence, and I believe that it does demonstrate that we're much better off than you think. So I'd better stop there. I had to leave out a couple of things, but in the next lecture I will try to review some of the experiments which have been done in accordance with this general program over the last 10 years or so, and try to assess what kind of significance they have for the interpretation of quantum mechanics.